The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Coming up on today's podcast,
where you see countries and regions that are mandating renewables, their electricity prices are skyrocketing. Australia, Germany, California. California, last year alone, California's electric rates went up 7.5% in 1 year. That was seven times the rate of increase in the rest of the U.S. So you are effectively mandating through these policies, regressive taxes on the poor and the middle class, and particularly when it comes to these natural gas bans.
Also,
you just cannot run a green economy and do this huge transformation without a lot of copper and a lot of silver. The only metal that conducts electricity better than copper is silver. And of course, silver for most applications is just far, far too expensive. And there's been talk recently because of the spike in the price of copper of replacing it with aluminum. But you put a lot of current through aluminum, it gets very hot and it burns. So there is no substitute right now and on the horizon for copper.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Well, all major indexes are in for maybe minor losses for the week as stock investors react to rising inflation. Whether it's producer prices or consumer prices, inflation is heating up. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to a special edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Today, we're going to look at a key issue that is going to emerge in this decade. We're going to take a look at resource scarcity, whether you're looking at silver, rare earth minerals, or copper. And then we're also going to look at the Green New Deal. Will it work? And how will it work? And where will the electricity come from when we're shutting down nuclear power plants and natural gas plants? We could be heading for another energy crisis. Robert Bryce, a documentary filmmaker and an author, will be joining us as we discuss his new documentary film, Juice, about electricity and his book. All of that coming up. But first, let's talk to Ryan Poplava to find out what moved the markets this week.
Well, there weren't any major news or event-driven catalysts this week that moved the narrative much away from the message yields and stocks are giving right now, and have been. That message is that inflation is transitory and earnings growth may have peaked. There have been a lot of conversation over those two subjects for the past month now as the reflationary sectors have been consolidating. Because investors have concerns over peak earnings, there has been a shift away from reflationary assets into high growth areas such as technology. Because many of those companies carry significant weight in the broad indices, we have hovered near old highs or even surpassed them, as is the case for the NASDAQ composite. This week, there were a few moments when it looked like equities were going to stage a record close, only for that strength to be faded later in the day or on the following day. There's a growing sense that it may be time for equities to take a breather, as the indices have done well heading into what could be some seasonality issues. Now, the S&P 500 closed down this week 1%, the NASDAQ down 1.9%, the Dow Jones Industrial Average down 0.5%, and the Russell 2000 down a whopping 5.1%. Let's get into the weeds, though, and you can decide for yourself whether you think earnings have peaked or inflation is transitory. Now, JP Morgan Chase, Goldman kicked off the earnings season on Tuesday with Bank of America, BlackRock, Citigroup, and Wells Fargo following things up on Wednesday. Of those companies, only Wells Fargo showed a positive stock reaction to its news, with the stock up 4%, while the rest were all down. John Butters from FactSet wrote on Friday that only 8% of the S&P 500 has reported this week, with 85% of those companies reporting earnings above estimates. If we finish at this pace, it will mark the second highest percentage of S&P 500 companies reporting earnings surprises since they began tracking the data in 2008. And in aggregate, companies are beating estimates by almost 23%. And that metric, too, would be the second highest on their records since 2008. So that's all to say it was a good start to things this week, but also disappointing to see the reactions. Now, Taiwan Semiconductor had a miss on earnings Thursday, which drove the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index down 2.2% on the day and down 4.1% on the week. That was a big hit to tech and perhaps the catalyst that did turn sentiment this week to cause even the tech stocks to close down. In economic news, nothing here corroborated with the idea from central bankers that inflation is transitory. But like a broken clock that's right twice a day, eventually the narrative will agree with their thinking. Treasury Secretary Yellen told NPR Thursday she thinks the high inflation we're seeing now will continue in the medium term. Powell told Congress Wednesday in his semi-annual testimony the same thing, that inflation will moderate and that substantial further progress is still a long ways off. Now, the consumer prices for June was up 0.9%, the largest monthly increase since June 2008, taking the year-over-year increase up to 5.4%. Now, the producer price index showing prices rose 1% in June, which was the same if you exclude energy and food. Year-over-year, on easy comparisons, pricings are running hot, up 7.3% for total and 5.6% excluding energy and food. Now, the Federal Bank of St. Louis Reserve President James Bullard responded Thursday just saying that it's time to pull back on stimulus. So not all the bankers agree, but as you have it, we've got Treasury yields heading lower, not up. After everything was said and done, the 10-year Treasury closed down to 1.3% on Friday from 1.35% last week. So despite one of the hottest inflationary month readings we've seen, and on 8 weeks of draw on energy inventories, the smart credit market said nope and continues to side with the Fed. Rates at one point did climb up to 1.42% in the middle of the week, but settled lower to finish the week. Not even the strong retail sales report Friday was able to hold the yield higher. Retail sales for June were up 0.6% for the month. Take autos out, and it was even stronger, up 1.3%. Now, the strength in the sales figure were largely in department sales stores, miscellaneous retailers, electronics, appliances, gas stores, clothing, and restaurants, as consumers show they're flush with cash and happy to go out and spend it. That's all of the key components I could squish into this wrap-up this week. Tune in next week as I dive more into the earnings season and highlight some of the key companies that are reporting.
Last year, Tian Yang, head of research at Variant Perception, warned our listeners that the consensus was underestimating the impact from COVID and to expect a big hit. That was in February of 2020 when he made that call right before markets collapsed and the consensus flipped his direction. We spoke with him on FS Insider to get an update on his outlook and where the consensus he believes, particularly when it comes to the Fed, is getting it wrong again.
In our view, inflation is still going to be high and persistent for a while, and the danger is that this feeds through into inflation expectation. Now, this is where I think it gets a bit tricky because the market's not really worried, but if you look at surveys, consumer surveys, surveys of businesses, you know, you just look at company quarter transcripts, you know, there's a heck of a lot more talk about inflation lasting longer than people thought.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, all the talk coming out of Washington is about the Green New Deal. We have an infrastructure program, and we have massive amounts of money that the Biden administration wants to allocate. Will it work, and what are the problems? Joining me on the program is Robert Bryce. He is an author, journalist, documentary filmmaker, public speaker, and recently a fellow at the Foundation for Research for Equal Opportunity. Robert, before we begin, I wonder if you would just share a little bit of your background with our audience and tell them, how did you get to this level of expertise in the area of power and electricity?
Well, thank you, Jim. Happy to be with you. I've been a journalist my whole career. I'm now some 30 years. I've been writing about energy and power system, energy and power for three decades. I also have a podcast now that I started in the last year or so. But yeah, I'm fascinated by the global energy business, have been for years. And to me, this is the world's most important industry. It's the industry upon which every other industry depends. And more recently, in the last 4 or 5 years, I've really focused on electricity. And those are the focal points of my new book, Question of Power, and also the documentary Juice, How Electricity Explains the World, both of which came out in the last 16 months.
I want to read from something. I have a transcript of your testimony before Congress. And one of the things you talked about, when we talk about electric vehicles, you talk about the resource intensity of batteries, increasingly fragile state of our electric grid. We saw that in California with brownouts and Texas. And we've got these bad policies that are being implemented. In other words, we want to go green, but I don't know if we've thought this through. Now, before Congress, you talked about three key things about going EV. One is affordability. Second is resilience. And third is supply chains. I wonder if we can begin with these three, beginning with affordability.
The affordability issue is one. I went to Costco a few months ago. You know, like a lot of people, I'm a member of Costco and, you know, buy my toilet paper by the bale. And I'm walking in, and what's out front? A Chevy Bolt. And I thought, oh, well, that's interesting. So I walk over to it, and the sticker on it, 46 large, about $46,000. I took a picture of it with my phone because I wanted to make sure I got a picture of the sticker. And then I went home and started looking at it. And I thought, okay, well, I could, for that much money for an all electric vehicle, I could buy a brand new BMW 3 Series, or I could buy a brand new Mercedes C Series. I looked it up, two Toyota Corollas at $18,000. I thought, well, this is insane. Why would anyone buy this vehicle with limited range, long refueling times, et cetera? So this is not, I've been writing about these vehicles now for 10 years. I wrote about them in my fourth book, Power Hungry. We've heard about the hype for electric vehicles for years. Why haven't they taken over the market? Well, one of the first problems is that you're just too expensive. You know, the average buyer of an electric vehicle in the United States has a household income of about $140,000. That's twice the U.S. average. So who's buying EVs today? Who's buying Teslas? It's the Benz and Beamer crowd. So to me, I just find that just in a certain way revolting, in that, oh, now the government is going, oh, we're going to build all these charging stations. Well, fine, but who's going to use them? It's going to be the Tesla crowd, not the low and middle income consumers. So just on the simple availability, you know, affordability issue, EVs fail, and they've been failing for a long time. And that's why they only amount to 2% of all current U.S. car sales. We've had government push for decades, and we still don't have enough consumer pull. And one of the main problems is that they're just not affordable.
Yeah, I think in your testimony, you talk about 42% of all EVs are in California. It's, you know, I call it the Tesla yuppies. I mean, and that you're exactly right. I had a friend that used to drive an S-Class Mercedes. He went to a Tesla. And so you see a lot of this in Orange County and around Southern California and the coastal cities, but you don't see them much anywhere else.
Well, you don't see them ever in working class neighborhoods. You just don't see them, nor do you see them in rural America. And this is one of the other big issues in terms of the discrepancy, this vast disparity in terms of all these government programs designed, including federal rebates on EVs. California has up to $7,000 rebate for EVs. In California, if you have an EV, you can ride in the HOV lane. If you're as a single driver, you know, their HOV lanes are for two or more people. You can drive in the HOV lane. It's a class issue. And this, to me, when it comes to the issue of, you know, of energy and power, it's all about affordability for me anymore. And nearly every one of these decarbonization programs that are being promoted by, and I will call them out, the Natural Resources Defense Council, the Sierra Club, the Environmental Defense Fund, all of these groups that are getting tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars from people like Jeff Bezos and Michael Bloomberg, they're pushing these policies for decarbonization, all of which will hurt the poor and the middle class. And I just find this a real problem for me because, yes, climate change is a concern. It's not the only concern.
You know, another issue that comes up with in terms of affordability, even if you could put some money down on a, let's say, an EV, we're going to high density housing, because housing, like in my own state of California, our definition of a millionaire is a homeowner. So sure. People can't afford to buy homes. They're going into condos. They're going into apartments. And if you're living in an apartment, Robert, how are you going to charge your EV?
Well, you won't. And that's the other key issue here. And, you know, one of the things that I've been following very closely, Jim, is this issue of attempts by authorities, government authorities, to limit vehicle miles traveled, VMT. And I've reported on the litigation that's happening in California being led by Latino groups, Latino leaders, who've sued the state over the VMT rules that are being implemented by the state of California. Well, why does this matter? It matters because of the issue of home ownership. The California has the highest poverty rate in America. It also has the largest Latino population. And who's suing the state over their VMT rules? It's the Latinos saying, look, not only are you making housing more expensive, you impose these VMT rules and you limit our mobility. Well, you limit their physical mobility, you limit their economic mobility. The people that are doing, you know, the trades, the carpenters, the plumbers, the people who, you know, work in service industry jobs, if they want to own a home, they can't live in La Jolla. They have to live somewhere inland and they're going to have to drive to their jobs. Well, if you limit their mobility, you limit their ability to own a home. You limit their economic mobility. And this is all of a piece, because it's all of these policies are being promulgated by, let's call them what they are, the elites, who think they know better what is the best for society. Well, it may be better for society, but for people who have limited incomes or want to have a home, it's terrible for them.
In addition to affordability, you talk about societal resilience. Let's talk about that. The thing that really disturbs me, and it's happening in our own state of California, in 2025, we'll shut down our last nuclear power plant, which is providing 10% of our electricity. There's a movement to shut down nat gas plants. And if you're shutting down your main sources of power, and I think you talk about, in order to get EVs working by 2035, we're going to need 1.2 million charging stations. And let's even assume, Robert, that we get maybe 30% or 40% of California to buy EVs. I think, once again, that may be a high number given the cost. But where is the power going to come? Because right now, I pull in the garage, you know, I turn my car off. That's it. You got an EV, you pull it in the garage, you're plugging it into the power system, so you're charging that at night, if not in the morning.
Well, and this is one of the points that, in fact, the California Public Utility Commission made in a report that was just issued a few months ago, saying that, in fact, that they were going to need more, they were going to have an extra generation available at night in order to charge these EVs, and put it at about 5,000 megawatts. Well, that is a big load. And remember, California, one of their big components of their power generation now is solar. Well, sun doesn't shine here in Austin at night. I don't think it shines in California at night, which means they're going to have to run that largely, all that recharging of those EVs with what? Fossil fuel plants. And the insanity of this and the insanity of what we're seeing in the bluest states in America, New York, California, and Illinois, are these lofty goals about renewables and decarbonization. At the same time, they're closing their nuclear plants. It's like Lily Tomlin said, no matter how cynical I get, I can't keep up. Well, you're going to talk about saving the climate. You're going to do all these things with renewables. You can't build new renewable capacity in New York or California, because there's so much local objection, especially in California. You can't build new wind capacity. In New York, the rejections are so strong and so widespread, the state has enacted a regulation that effectively allows the state to enact eminent domain over local zoning rules when it comes to renewables. And yet they're saying we're going to do all this, and they're closing their nuclear plants. It just makes no sense whatsoever. But this speaks to, unfortunately, this incredible political power that's held by the Natural Resources Defense Council, the Sierra Club, in getting these plants closed, despite their importance to societal resilience, despite their importance to having fuel diversity, which is essential if you're going to have energy security, and despite the fact that they're closing them and they're being replaced with natural gas-fired power plants. I mean, it's loony round the bend. I mean, I just can't, I struggle to come up with adjectives, and I'm paid to write for a living, how insanely dumb this is.
Well, what we're doing is, if you take a look at our grid system now and where we get our electricity. So we have nuclear power, we have natural gas, we have hydroelectric, we have renewables, and we have we have coal. So we have like five sources of creating electricity. What these guys are talking about is getting rid of everything and just going to one source, renewables, when the renewable power structure is intermittent at best.
Well, and back to the resilience point, Jim, and it's one that I made in my testimony before the House Select Committee on the Climate Crisis, that's the name of the committee, on June 30th, was the number of grid interruptions or major grid outages that are being tracked by the Department of Energy. They have nearly tripled just since 2016. And for me, this is really personal now. And I say that with, no exaggeration. I live in the central part of Austin, Texas. We were blacked out in February due to Winter Storm Uri. So I know what it is to lose power for an extended period of time. Well, what was the problem? Well, in Texas, before the blackouts, there were $66 billion spent on wind and solar. They got $22 billion in subsidies, by the way, for building that capacity. $66 billion spent. And all of that spending was effectively worth nothing at 2 a.m. on February 15th. And yet we're going to add more load to the grid that is now becoming being fragilized by the closure of our baseload plants, coal and nuclear, and the increased adoption of renewables. This is bad policy. It's bad policy. We need fuel diversity to assure energy security. And that's just being disregarded by these promoters of by the climate catastrophists who are saying, oh, we have to electrify everything and we have to do it all right now. They aren't even beginning to think about first principles, and that's a real problem.
So as we take a look at this, I want to move on to supply chains, because if you take a look at the amount of raw materials, I mean, everybody says, oh, we're going green, Tesla's green, but they don't understand. Tesla requires cobalt, it requires copper, manganese, rare earth elements, and a good majority of these raw materials are controlled by China. Our largest copper mine potential is in Alaska. They won't let them mine it. You can't mine in California. So if we're going to be doing this, we're going to need raw materials in addition to a steady supply of electricity to run this, or it's not going to work.
Well, and I wrote about the issue of rare earth elements in my fourth book, Power Hungry, and this is 11 years ago. Chinese control, according to the May report from the International Energy Agency, China controls something like 90% of the global market in rare earth elements, neodymium, praseodymium, lanthanum, all of these things that are needed for hybrid vehicles, for high strength magnets that are critical to all of these alternative energy technologies. And yet, I mean, it was just a few days ago that a group of climate activist groups sent a letter to the administration effectively saying, oh, don't be too hard on China. Well, wait up just a damn minute. you're going to promote China over American interests? Hold on. I mean, for nearly my entire life, I've turned 61 this year. I've heard nothing. The continuing drumbeat from Congress has been, we have to be careful about not importing critical materials, particularly oil from OPEC. And now all of that's being thrown overboard by this idea that, oh, we'll just rely on the Chinese for critical minerals. This makes no sense whatsoever from a strategic standpoint, from a, an international trade standpoint. It's crazy town. But, good luck reading about this in The New York Times. They won't write about it. They just won't.
Robert, when you were before Congress and talking to these people, do any of these politicians, they make these legislative or executive fiat, like in California, 2035, you can't sell gas engines anymore. Did they ever think through the consequences, or they just pass it and say, okay, we're going to do this and we're going to get this all done? Because a lot of the emphasis coming from the Greens is, if we don't do this, we're all going to die in 10 years.
Well, and it goes, I think that's, a pretty fair analysis, in that this idea that climate concern trumps everything else. Well, no, it doesn't. And especially when it comes to the issues of personal energy security. I mean, I refer back to what happened in February. Well, we did okay, right? Our power went out, but we had natural gas plumbed into the house when we bought it 21 years ago. Well, and thank God we did. So we could rely on gas. So we could heat water. We, you know, we had hot water. We could take a shower if we wanted to. We had, we could cook. We could put, you know, stove, you know, on the stove, we had, you know, pots. So we could hear, you know, have steam in the house. And we had a fireplace. So we had firewood. So we had fuel diversity, which meant energy, personal energy security. And we had gasoline in the cars out sitting out in the driveway. So things really got bad when we go sit out there and get warmed up. We didn't have to do that. But this idea that we're going to put all of our energy eggs in one basket, that we'll put it all on the electric grid, and this electric grid somehow is going to be fueled completely by renewable energy. Never mind that from Maine to Hawaii, rural communities are saying, we don't want wind turbines, take them somewhere else. We don't want them. And I've documented this in a report that I published in April. Over 300 communities from coast to coast have rejected restricted wind projects, including some in California just in the last few weeks near Shasta. So all of these projections about what has to be done in the name of green, they completely disregard basic ideas about first principles. Where are you going to put it? How are you going to connect it? How are you going to pay for it? And all of that's just thrown overboard with this blithe kind of assumption. Well, we just need the political will. Okay, yeah, maybe we need something just besides political will, maybe some common sense about what the second and third order effects of what you're proposing are.
Yeah, and let's talk also about the footprint of renewables. You take a look at a solar array farm. I think Warren Buffett is putting in solar panels north of Vegas, 7,000 acres of solar panels. You compare that to the footprint of a nuclear power plant.
Well, again, you know, this is where I use the word crazy town, because it's crazy town. In the film, and it's called Juice, How Electricity Explains the World. It's on the Roku channel. We went to the Indian Point nuclear plant in Buchanan, New York, before it was shuttered. It was shuttered in April of this year with the backing, with the push from the Natural Resources Defense Council. Well, I did the simple calculation to replace the output from Indian Point, a 2-megawatt plant, which sat, or 2,000 megawatt plant, 2-gigawatt plant, sat on 1 square kilometer. To replace the output of Indian Point with wind energy would require at least 1,300 square kilometers, 1,300 times the land's footprint of the Indian Point nuclear plant. And yet they shuttered it. Why? Because of just relentless fear mongering by the Sierra Club, by Riverkeeper, by all of these groups. And they don't give a damn about the low and middle income people. And they don't give a damn about grid resilience. I mean, it's just, it's terrible, terrible public policy.
So we are stopping in California, I think, when several counties have passed laws that any new construction for residential homes, you're not going to be able to use natural gas. So you won't have a natural gas range. You won't have a natural gas heater, a natural gas heat pump. You won't have a natural gas dryer. So which means we'll be using more electricity. And, you know, the last power out that we had here in California, thank God I had a outdoor gas-filled barbecue so I could go out and cook because I couldn't cook in the house.
Well, and this is the part, again, that you know, you can't make this up. The United States is now the Saudi Arabia of natural gas. We were a prospective importer of natural gas. Now we're a natural gas exporter. The U.S. is by far the world's biggest producer of natural gas. And yet the push that's being underway now by the Rocky Mountain Institute, by Sierra Club, Rocky Mountain Institute is getting money from the Bezos Earth Fund. Sierra Club's getting tens of millions of dollars from Michael Bloomberg. They're pushing these natural gas bans. Okay, so fine. Let's talk about that in California. Well, California, again, has the highest poverty rate in the country. It has the largest Latino population. And the price of electricity relative to the price of natural gas is 4 times on an energy equivalent basis. So effectively, by banning natural gas, you are imposing a regressive climate tax on the poor and the middle class. And yet that's never discussed in those ways. And yet that's exactly what is happening. And so it just is incredible to me that this is happening. Gina McCarthy is the name of the woman who is the head of the NRDC. And she's now Joe Biden's top climate advisor. Well, you have an anti-nuclear person working in the White House. At a time when the White House and Biden administration are calling this an existential threat, well, if it's an existential threat, you keep the nuclear plants open. And instead, here's Gina McCarthy in the top echelon of the United States government, and she's anti-nuclear. I mean, it's unconscionable. I mean, it really does. I mean, as my late brother used to say, grill my cheese.
Well, I tell you, I mean, there's been more deaths from fossil fuels than there ever has been from nuclear power. And the nuclear power reactors they have today are much safer, they're much smaller, and they're more ideal to provide a steady source of power for a long term. So I think I read in your piece that you would be okay with EVs if we start building nuclear power plants like the Chinese and the rest of the world's doing, but we're not doing it.
You're still going to have issues with grid stability. You're still going to have issues with the availability of copper and with rare earth elements when it comes to electric vehicles, with stress on the grid. So yes, but the answer is yes. If nuclear power was playing a bigger role, I'd be much more inclined to support EVs, but that's not happening. Instead, we're closing our nuclear plants. I wrote a piece, I think it was earlier this year, about the number of plants that are being slated for closure just this year. So it was Indian Point Unit 3, which is already closed, and then the Byron and Dresden plants in Illinois. Together, those plants, when you combine their output was something on the order of 40 terawatt hours a year. Well, that's roughly equal to the output of all the wind and solar installations in California. Now think about that. Why would we ever close these plants? If climate change is the threat, why would they be closed? It makes no sense whatsoever. And yet that's what's happening. So, you know, again, I'm increasingly convinced that the Biden administration and the Democratic Party in America, they're not really as serious about climate change, because they talk about reducing emissions, but all they want to do is build renewables. Well, reducing emissions and building renewables are not the same thing.
You know, the only thing that I guess I'm hesitant, whenever the government gets involved and they're directing money, you start running into issues like Solyndra and a bunch of other things where a lot of money is being thrown about with lobbyists and influence, and a lot of this stuff goes belly up.
Well, exactly. And you see that with the production tax credit and the investment tax credit, which are used by the wind and solar industries respectively, the ITC and the PTC were both extended in the last few weeks by the Internal Revenue Service. There was no vote by Congress. There was no congressional action involved. They just got through administrative fiat an extension of a very lucrative tax treatment that will cost the federal treasury billions of dollars. And yet it was barely reported on, because these are favored industries who have very powerful lobbies in Washington, and they ask for whatever they want, and they seem like they get it. And it just is, there's no other way to describe it, but as corporate cronyism or crony corporatism. And, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine here in Austin, Bill Peacock. He said, well, I said, you're not calling it crony capitalism. He says, no, I'm pro-capitalism. This isn't capitalism. This is cronyism. This is corporatism.
Yeah, it's amazing when you take a look at the amount of money that's being thrown about. When you were before Congress and you were presenting these three key points about resiliency, the supply chain, and affordability, what was the reaction?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I was invited to speak by the minority, right? The Republicans. The Democrats didn't ask me any questions. So they didn't want to talk to me about the issues that I raised. There was one congressman, Jared Huffman, who's a Democrat from California. And he didn't like what I had to say, of course, because I was attacking California in the main, right? Pointing out the problems with affordability, issues with charging stations in California, the fact that electric rates in California are absolutely exploding, all the problems that are obvious when you look at what's going on. So he attacked me, you know, saying, oh, well, you know, the minority, they're never in favor of anything. And so I said, may I respond? He says, no, you can't say anything. This is my 5 minutes. I thought, okay, fine. Well, so I've thought about it since, and what am I in favor of? Well, I'm in favor of low-cost energy. I'm in favor of nuclear energy, and I'm in favor absolutely of resilience and fuel diversity. And yet those points seem to make no headway when it comes to the Democratic Party, because I increasingly, as I said, I'm convinced they're really not interested in cutting emissions. They're interested in building renewables, because the patronage that comes through building renewables, that is lucrative, and that's why they do it. And it's not about keeping existing plants open, because there's no money in it for them. And I say that with no relish, but I think that's what is increasingly obvious.
Well, let's talk about Wall Street, which is pushing this. I just read an article in the Journal today. There's just literally hundreds of billions of dollars that are going into green energy IPOs. The fossil fuel industry is starving for money. I mean, you know, if you're a shale producer, good luck if you want to go out and try to raise capital. And the other thing that Wall Street's doing, which I think is alarmingly dangerous, is they're getting seats on our major oil companies. And the one that comes to mind is Exxon. So Exxon took a different track than most of the major oil companies. They were investing in exploring because they saw a need for more fuel in this decade. And they made one of the largest discoveries off the coast of Ghana in 2018. Now you've got Wall Street getting seats on the board, and they want these companies to divest themselves of their assets. So how's that going to work if the transition doesn't go as quickly or smoothly as these politicians are planning?
The obvious answer is that the price of oil is going to skyrocket, and we've already seen that. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, when you think about what Jim Konka wrote, a very perceptive piece in Forbes, oh gosh, I think it was maybe 9 months ago, maybe even longer. And he was talking about what the likely results of COVID are going to be. And one of the points he made was that people are going to be using less mass transit. They're going to be driving more. And that's exactly what we've seen. So we're seeing gasoline demand skyrocketing. We're seeing the UBS, I think just the other day, or one of the other big iBanks projected that global oil demand will be back to where it was by early next year. Well, why is that? It's because there's an old railroad guy named Don Cheatham who lived here in Austin. I've lost touch with him, but it was years ago. He said something I thought was fascinating. He said, without transportation, there's no commerce. Well, without oil, there's no transportation. So without oil, then there's no commerce. And this is a fundamental commodity. It's been a fundamental commodity in the global economy now for decades. And yet there's this claim, oh, we're just going to move on and we don't need it anymore. Well, no. Show me that you don't need it. Build your other infrastructure that's going to prove that you don't need that. Instead, there's this idea, oh, we're just going to shut off the taps because we're going to something else. No. You build the new house before you move out of the old one. You don't just burn down the old house and say, we're going to build a new one. But in fact, that's effectively what's happening.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you take a look at the transition from horses to the automobile at the beginning of the last century, it took almost like three decades to the time where you got gas stations, tire places, freeways, roads, all the things that are necessary for the automobile. Dwight Eisenhower came in after World War II and he built the national freeway system so that you could go from one coast to the next. So a lot of this stuff, they're talking about doing this in years instead of decades. I'm skeptical. I don't think they're going to be able to do it.
Well, I don't think so either. And the key issue is not even necessarily a lack of money or political will. It goes back to first principles. And it's as my friend Lee Cordner, who worked for the California ISO for many years, he said, where are you going to put it? How are you going to connect it? And how are you going to pay for it? Well, the where you're going to put it is the first question, and it's never been satisfactorily answered. Instead, it's been this, oh, we'll get back to you. Oh, we're just going to build it, you know, out there in flyover country. Well, okay, so let's bring this back to the reality of where we are now. Last December, Madison County, Iowa, passed an ordinance banning new wind turbines in Madison County. Madison County, of course, is famous for its covered bridges. A few weeks later, they got sued by MidAmerican Energy, a subsidiary of Berkshire Hathaway, the chairman of which is Warren Buffett, who famously said the only reason to build wind turbines is for the tax credits. Otherwise, there's no reason to build them. So here you have one of America's biggest companies suing a small county in Iowa because they want more tax credits because the county said, we don't want your damn wind turbines. And yet this is, I don't read about it in the New York Times. I don't read about it in the Wall Street Washington Post. It doesn't fit the narrative that, oh, we're just going to build all these renewables. Well, where are you going to put it? So there's this, and that doesn't even get to the how are you going to connect it, which is high voltage transmission. How do they think they're going to get all this high voltage transmission built when, again, all across rural America, states are saying we don't want high voltage transmission built across our counties or our states. It's what we saw in Iowa. It's what we see still in Missouri today. We see it in Arkansas. All across the country, rural communities are saying, no way, we don't want this. And yet there's this blithe kind of claim that, oh, we're just going to make this happen. Well, okay, well, show me. And because therein lies the rub. It's just been this, you know, assumption, well, we'll just make all this happen. Well, you haven't. Not yet.
So if we look at where we're going, Wall Street is getting on boards of our major oil companies, forcing them to divest themselves of assets. We're not approving pipelines, at least here. And then on top of that, we're shutting down nuclear power plants. We're shutting down that gas plants. At the same time, we're pushing this EV. And as you talked about in affordability, I just don't think a lot of, the poor or the middle class are going to be able to pony up for $46,000 for a Chevy Volt.
Well, no, of course they won't. They're, and it's the same in rural America. When I drive in rural America, and I do so fairly often, I don't see Teslas. I see F-150s. I see F-250s and F-350s. I see a lot of Silverados and Dodge Rams. And so who's going to benefit? Well, it's the people who have more money, who live in cities and don't have these long commutes and aren't hauling trailers or hay or, what have you. The other part of this is that when you look at where electricity prices are going up and you have a very clear record where you see countries and regions that are mandating renewables, their electricity prices are skyrocketing. Australia, Germany, California. California, last year alone, California's electric rates went up 7.5% in 1 year. That was seven times the rate of increase in the rest of the U.S. So you are effectively mandating through these policies, regressive taxes on the poor and the middle class, and particularly when it comes to these natural gas bans. But you don't ever hear the Sierra Club talking about that, do you? I mean, it's just that they don't want to talk about that because that doesn't fit their narrative that climate change trumps all of their concerns.
Yeah, when we built our house, we built it in, we put on solar panels. So, I wanted to cover most of the cost of the house. And a couple of years ago, I started getting big bills, and it turned out the utility came in and they doubled the rates during prime time. So I had to go out and spend another $16,000, add another 12 panels. I have now 54 solar panels powering this house, but that's what it took. You know, I'm fortunate enough that I'm able to afford that, but not too many people can.
Well, and bully for you, Jim, but by doing that, you are outsourcing some of the costs of maintaining the grid. And this is one of the problems, a big problem facing the state of California, is that the more the electric rates go up, the more people like you are going to do exactly what you did. You're going to effectively secede from the electric grid, but you still have a grid-tied system. So you're buying fewer watt hours from your utility. Therefore, the utility has fewer dollars to cover the cost of maintaining the entire system. Therefore, they raise rates across the entire system. And it doesn't matter to you because you've effectively seceded. But for the baristas and the janitors and the people who are mechanics and carpenters, they're going to pay a little more. And so this will be a big problem going forward for California because that process will feed on itself. The more rates go up, the more people will say, hey, I'm going to put solar panels on the roof of my house. And the fewer watt hours get sold by the electric utility and the higher the base rates go up for everyone to cover the costs of wildfire prevention and upgrading transformers and building new lines and all the other things that you know about.
Yeah, because I mean, the next thing we're going to do is we're going to put in Tesla batteries because, I have solar, but when we get a brownout, my house gets shut down just like everybody else's.
Yeah. So this is one of the other issues again. And I wouldn't put a battery pack in my house. Are you crazy? I've watched all the fires that have happened with electric vehicles. I wouldn't do it. But I do now have a generator, a 6,000 watt generator. But yeah, I mean, this is a real issue that is going to be, I think, has not been sufficiently discussed. It's not, hasn't had the kind of focus in terms of resilience that it needs. But this is going to be the big challenge in the years ahead, that how are we going to, if we're going to push for decarbonization in the way that is being discussed by all of these powerful lobby groups, what is it going to mean for affordability? What is it going to mean for resilience? And what is it going to mean for supply chains? And none of them want to talk about that because there's too much money at stake. It's the oldest maxim in politics. Follow the money.
So when does this come crashing down or come to a head? Because, as we look at, we are not allowing any mining for copper, silver, rare earths. We're not doing that. We're shutting down or asking our oil companies to divest. We're not approving new leases for drilling. So when does this come to a head?
Well, I hope it doesn't take a crisis. I think what it's, it may take just more populism and the Republicans are going to have to kind of, I think, and I'm not a strategist here. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I'm just disgusted. But I think that there's going to have to be some rationality injected into the debate here to say, well, hold on, we've got to be careful here about what we're doing, because if we push this too far, then it's going to be just truly catastrophic for low and middle income people. But we're very close to that point already, I think.
Well, you know, what is it, 2025, we shut down Diablo Canyon. And do you think they'll follow through with shutting down the nat gas plants here? Or do you think they may be looking and saying, wait a minute, if we do that, what are we going to do if this stuff doesn't work?
Well, I'm still hopeful. Jim, I'm you know, optimistic to the point of idiocy, to use a line that was coined by Molly Ivins, that sanity will prevail and that they won't close Diablo Canyon. Because this is a critical, I mean, forget that it's a nuclear plant, but that plant by itself provides 10% of the electricity for California, 10%, and the biggest slice of its zero carbon electricity. But so it may happen that they keep that plant open, but I just don't think that there's any potential for them to do without natural gas fired generation in California, not for the foreseeable future. I don't care how many batteries they put in.
Final question. In your documentary film, you went to 5 or 6 places around the world. You went to Lebanon, you went to Colorado, and various places. And Puerto Rico, which was really sad to see that, what's happened to that island. Why did you choose them?
Well, to give you the full list, India, Iceland, Puerto Rico, New York, Colorado. We went to Lebanon because I'd always wanted to, frankly, I always wanted to see Beirut, and it's a beautiful city and total crisis now. But I'd read about Beirut for years and the generator mafia, that the grid there is so badly managed and the government is so corrupt that the grid fails every day. They have blackouts every day. So ordinary Lebanese rely on the generator mafia, which are local neighborhood generators that they pay a subscription fee to so they can assure regular electricity. We went to India for the obvious reason that this is one of the largest countries in the world in terms of population, and they have some of the biggest challenges in terms of electrification, that the average Indian uses something like 800 kilowatt hours per capita per year, which is less than what my old kitchen refrigerator used. So we wanted to see that energy poverty there ourselves. And, you know, people have asked me about the film, which I'm very proud of, and by the way, is on the Roku channel for free. It's called Juice, How Electricity Explains the World. You can see it on the web at juicethemovie.com. But one of the things that truly did surprise me and shock me, and I've lived a long, full life, and I've seen good bit of the world. The level of poverty in India was something I just wasn't prepared for. I had no idea the depth of it. And what it showed me in India, where electricity theft is rampant in some areas, that people will do whatever they have to do to get the electricity they need. That, yes, climate change, a lot of them are concerned. People in Puerto Rico, when we went there after Hurricane Maria, they were concerned about climate change, but they said, we're going to use whatever we have to do to get the power we need. So they were using small gasoline generators. But those travels really did open my eyes, Jim, to, you know, the broader human experience, of course, but also to the enormous challenge that we face in making things work. And that people are not, I don't care whether they're black, white, brown, green, orange, yellow, they're not going to be content to sit in the dark. They're just not. And so they're going to do whatever they have to do to get the electricity they need. And that's exactly what they're doing. And damn well they should.
Well, I tell you, it was, I watched your documentary and I was just heart-wrecking to watch what happened to the residents in Puerto Rico, you know, with, I guess that one family you talked about, they could only afford to keep their generator on 5 hours a day because they're spending so much on gasoline versus when the grid was working and the grid is up. Is there anything that's happening either from the Biden administration or the Trump administration before it about talking about, you know, investing money? I know there's tax benefits. One of the great things about Puerto Rico, if you're an American and you don't want to pay any federal income taxes, move to Puerto Rico and you got rid of your federal income taxes. There's been incentives for pharmaceutical companies to locate there. Is there anything like that going on to help that nation?
Well, I can't speak to all of the things, but one of the things that's clear is that there needs to be more reliable generation, and they're relying far too heavily on oil-fired generators. And because they're using oil, it's crazy expensive. They should be using natural gas. Even better, and there's a group, I've forgotten their name, the leader, one of the leaders, the name of a guy named Jesus Nunez, they're pushing for nuclear power on the island, which I think would be perfect, would be a very good solution. Small footprint, you know, their transmission grid is very weak, but they could put the power plant on the sites of any of the number of the power plants that they have in the country. So there are solutions that are available, but the fact is that, you know, let's be clear, Puerto Rico doesn't have any stroke on Capitol Hill in Washington because they don't have a seat in Congress. They're a colony of the United States. And so, and because of that status, they just simply don't, you know, they don't rank in terms of any kind of priority for legislators, which is deeply unfortunate, but I'm hopeful. Reason should prevail. And I hope that it does, because the people of Puerto Rico who are American citizens on American soil deserve better.
Well, I tell you, there's nothing to get the attention of politicians when you have a bunch of brownouts and things and the lights don't turn on to be a frustrated voter. So, Robert, as we close, tell our listeners about your website, the name of the book you've recently written. It's called A Question of Power, Electricity and the Wealth of Nations. And then your new documentary film, which you can see on Roku or Amazon Prime, Juice, How Electricity Explains the World.
Well, thank you. So I'm easy to find on the interweb, on the Google. My website is robertbrice.com. I'm on Twitter at PWR Hungry, at Power Hungry. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm pretty easy to find, but I do encourage all of your listeners, and I'm flattered to be on your show, Jim, but yes, by all means, buy my book. You don't have to read it. You just have to buy it.
Well, I tell you, it's well written. So I would urge my listeners, because you open up, you're talking about things that we don't see anywhere. You're not seeing it on the evening news. You're not seeing it in our major newspapers. You're not seeing it coming out of Washington. And, you know, if we don't get our act together, we're going to have a power and energy crisis here in the not-too-distant future. Well, listen, Robert, I want to thank you for coming on the program. All the best and good luck, and I hope to talk to you again.
Thanks a million, Jim.
Fully autonomous weaponry is now here. The only question is, how long will humans remain in the loop when it comes to future military conflicts? Occasionally, we on FS Insider like to go beyond the scope of economics and finance and discuss the latest technological developments, in this case when it comes to fully autonomous weaponry. FS Insider spoke with Chris Osborne, a military technology expert previously working at the Pentagon, to explain how far we've come with AI and machine learning in drones, unmanned vehicles, and what we should expect in the next war or major power conflict. Here's a clip of what he told listeners this week on FS Insider.
Combat platform is not an isolated platform such as a bomber or a missile or even a fighter jet, but rather a node as part of a meshed, interwoven, multi-domain combat network. Now, algorithms are progressing to the point where much greater degrees of autonomy are possible. So you can have a drone that can find, track, detect, distill, discern, analyze, and then attack a target without needing human intervention.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
The Biden administration is putting forth the Green New Deal as the country tries to merge to a green economy. Well, what is it going to take to make that work? Let's find out. Joining us on the program is Keith Barron. He's chairman and CEO of Arania Resources. Keith, you know, I'm looking as, you know, the Biden administration and globally, we're seeing more and more car manufacturers converting their fleet to electric vehicles. And here in my own state of California, as of 2030, you won't be able to buy gas cars. To make all of this work, I think what is being left out of the picture is the importance of key materials like silver and copper. Let's begin our discussion with copper, which is a key raw material for the green economy.
Absolutely. Well, you're spot on, Jim. You know, you just cannot run a green economy and do this huge transformation that they're all envisioning without a lot of copper and a lot of silver. The only metal that conducts electricity better than copper is silver. And of course, silver for most applications is just far, far too expensive. So instead, we use copper. We have copper in windings for electric motor. We have copper in conduction for conveying electricity from place to place. And, you know, there's been talk recently because of the spike in the price of copper of replacing it with aluminum. Well, that's well and good. But, you know, if you put a lot of current through aluminum, it gets very hot and it burns. Copper is just going to melt on you. It may leave a little bit of a mess, but it's not going to burn your house down. So really, there is no substitute right now and on the horizon for copper. And we are running into a deficit situation, not just here in the United States, but worldwide.
So, Keith, when we talk about this green economy, we're talking about electric cars, batteries, then you're going to talk about charging stations. And it's not just that. Let's move that aside for a minute and talk about this heat wave that we're seeing around the globe as more and more countries and with the heat want air conditioning units. So it's not just electric vehicles, electric charging stations. It's in windmills and all the other things that we're using in this green economy. But let's talk about also weather and air conditioners.
Well, look how vulnerable this whole system is to collapse. So they have a heat wave in Texas, and very unfortunately, a lot of people died from it. But everybody put their air conditioners on all at the same time, and they collapsed the grid. And this is the situation. Now, as global warming continues and perhaps even picks up and becomes more of an issue in populated countries, people are going to want more air conditioners. And an air conditioner contains, right now, the technology. It's about 3 pounds of copper per air conditioner in the form of tubes. So that, you know, collectively, you put all that together and add it up, and it's a mountain of copper just by itself.
So, and if we talk about not just copper for EVs, charging stations, also let's talk about silver and its use in solar panels, windmills, and things of that nature. So if you're talking about green, you're talking about two key minerals, both silver and copper. And as I understand, they're in short supply.
Yes, indeed. Well, silver has been in deficit for years. The situation is that there is not enough new mine supply to satisfy the demand. And we've been dipping in essentially stockpiles for years and years and years. Silver is used in solar panels. And the reason for it is because of both its ability to conduct electricity, but also the kind of the mirror finish on the plates. So, you know, because of the reflectivity of silver, which is extremely high. So, you know, to some extent, silver is essential. I believe that the number right now, I think 15% of the world's newly mined silver is just going into solar panels. And that is a hell of a lot of metal. So, you know, both in the copper space and in the silver space, there is no wiggle room. Everything that is produced is consumed. And this is a big problem going forward. And, you know, I think that the greenies out there and the NIMBYs and all the rest of them who don't want to have a mine in their backyard, they don't realize perhaps that they're sabotaging the green revolution. It cannot happen without new mines or expansion of existing mines. That's the only way you're going to get the copper and the silver. It cannot come from recycling. things. There's just not enough stuff that is being recycled. And also, the world's population is increasing. So the only way to actually go ahead and satisfy this demand is with new copper and silver deposits. The largest copper mine right now is Escondida in Chile. And really, the industry has to find an Escondida every year going forward in order to satisfy the Green Revolution copper demand. And, you know, this is just not electric cars. And of course, electric cars use 3 times more copper than is in a conventional gasoline-driven car. So that's a tremendous use of copper just by itself. But just think about all the lines that have to be put in to conduct this electricity from A to B, to all the charging stations that have to be wired into the grid. And the grid itself, a lot of the grid in the U.S. was built really between 1900 and around 1930. And then in the 1940s, of course, a lot of the copper was redirected for the war effort. But the grid is old, and the grid is not built to take electricity from solar panels on people's roofs back the other way to some sort of to put it back into the grid. It's not designed that way. It's designed to take electricity in one direction. And really, to upgrade this thing and make it the way that it needs to be, you're almost going to have to replace the entire grid. I look at this, Jim, as a renaissance, a new renaissance for the copper business, which, you know, the last renaissance when America and when Europe electrified, electrification and put all the power poles in and connected up all the houses and all the rest of it. It's a tremendous use of copper. Where did that copper come from? It came from companies like Asarco, like Anaconda Copper, like Guggenex, which was run by the Guggenheims, a number of these things, and they're all defunct. And the copper deposits mostly that were exploited at that time are gone. They've been exhausted. So in order to experience this massive green revolution that all the politicos wants and that the younger woke generation wants, you're going to have to really recreate the wheel here in terms of the mining business.
You know, Keith, nobody seems to be thinking this through critically. I mean, if we're going to go to EVs, electric economy, but we're shutting down, like in my own state of California, we shut down our 2 nuclear power plants. And if you're not going to allow nuclear power, natural gas plants to be built, and at the same time, you are stopping the mining of new deposits. I think there's a big copper deposit in Alaska. There's several copper deposits in Arizona, but they're all in litigation. So if you won't allow mining and you won't allow building new power plants, how's this all going to work?
Well, exactly. Yeah. And the largest copper deposit, which has gone into production recently, that's Kamoa-Kakula in the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo. That's about 39% owned by the Chinese. And then another 39% is owned by Ivanhoe. And Ivanhoe's biggest shareholder is also the Chinese. So where do you think the copper is going to go to? It's not going to come to the U.S. It's not going to go to Europe. It's going to go to China. And the Chinese have invested in this, not because they want to make money. They've invested it because they want the product and they can see the crunch coming. In fact, the crunch is already here. So this is kind of like an offtake agreement, and they're securing the supply for their own people and for their own country. And I'm sure that they're not going to share it out to everybody else. So, yeah, you know, you're spot on. There's a number of very, very big projects here in the U.S. that are in litigation right now, some of which have been in litigation for decades. And, you know, every time somebody proposes a new mine in North America, there's a fight. Usually the NGOs attack the Bureau of Land Management or the Army Corps of Engineers or whoever has permitted it because they think that they're a softer target than the actual mining company. And these things get held up almost indefinitely. So that's the situation right now. And really, the chairman of Barrick came out the other day, and Barrick has got an interest in copper, and they've also expressed interest in acquiring copper deposits. And he said, look, you know, the exploration money that's going to go towards copper exploration this year is actually 10% down from previous years. And this does not make any sense. That's 10% across the industry. So, you know, companies...
And what's causing that, Keith? Why, with the price of copper rising, why is there less investment?
I think a lot of it is, it's a structural thing that they're afraid to go out and explore greenfields areas. There's more of a direction towards what we call brownfields or existing copper mines, expanding them. But, you know, the grade of a copper deposit right now worldwide is about 0.7%. And there are mines out there that are being operated on a very, very large scale, which are as low as 0.2%. And they make not much money. The margin is not great. But heck, you know, if you don't have anything else, what are you going to do? And so this is what they do. They look in the backyard, and they decide that they're going to mine low grade. Now, the other side of the coin in all this is something that we call a commodities or resource nationalism. And resource nationalism, its ugly head has raised yet again and recently, both in Peru and in Chile as a result of the outcomes of national elections. So in Chile right now, they're talking about rewriting the constitution sometime this fall. In Peru, the recent election is still in contention. And the person who's running in second, who is kind of a centrist or on the right, has lodged an appeal. We don't know what the results of that appeal will be. But nevertheless, the president in waiting, so to speak, the one who's won the election, is a socialist bordering on a communist who has talked about rewriting all the tax and stability agreements with the various companies in the country. The whole purpose of having a stability agreement is so that the government, when it changes, they can't change the rules on you. And this guy wants to null everything and start over. And of course, he wants to start over with the government having a bigger piece of it. And he's also talked about nationalizing the industry. Fortunately, the Congress is composed of mostly of people in the center on the right, and he is not going to be able to push through a lot of the gaga nutty things that he was talking about as he was campaigning. So there's going to be a certain amount of pragmatism going on here. But Chile, which is, I think, ostensibly anyway, the largest copper producer country in the world, they've got potentially a nasty situation here with a new constitution being written. And, of course, the government is going to take a bigger chunk of everything. So, you know, resource nationalism is essentially when the value of commodities goes up, the value of metals go up, then governments get greedy. They see these things as a cash cow, and they promote the things in a populist fashion to the people, saying, you know, this is the property of the states. You know, this is our birthright, and those nasty foreigners who are in here mining, it shouldn't really be here. And, you know, the rhetoric goes on and on and on. And at the end of the day, they try to take a bigger chunk. And this hasn't happened just in South America. A few years ago, it brought down the government in Australia. They were trying to take a bigger chunk of the iron ore industry. Just last night, it was announced that in Russia, they're going to bring in what's called an extraction tax. And unfortunately, if you're a mining company, you can't pick up the mine and move it to another jurisdiction, to another country. You're stuck. You have to put up with whatever the government comes up with. And sometimes these things are really, really screwball. Where I work in Ecuador, down in South America, we've already had, you know, we had maybe 14, 15 years of screwball thinking coming from the former president, Correa, who was friends with both Chavez and Ahmadinejad. He was a real nutcase. And he tried to bring in a windfall profits tax for the industry, the mining industry, which really killed all investments. That was repealed. That's gone away. There are two operating mines right now. One of them is mining gold hand over fist, doing a great job. And it's a couple percent of the GDP. And that's the way things should be. And that's the way things need to be for these countries to grow their economies. So, you know, the end result is that if these countries don't lighten up and loosen up and let people get on with the exploration and get on with the development of their commodities, and especially things that are essential like rare earths, like copper, like silver, then we're going to be in a real bind. There is just no way possible to hit all of these targets that have been put out there by the Biden government, by the EU, by other jurisdictions to really to get rid of fossil fuel.
Keith, I want to talk about copper for a minute, because the industry or some experts would argue that the mining companies have replaced their reserves over the last couple of decades. But where has that come from? It certainly hasn't come from mine discoveries. I haven't read, or at least I'm not aware of, major new copper discoveries that are now brought online that are replacing the reserves of all the copper that's been produced.
Yeah, well, there's actually only two brand new copper mines that are of any significant size. And one of them is in the DRC that I mentioned. You know, what has just happened is that the mining companies are mining lower grade. So 10 years ago, they were mining stuff that was averaging 1.1% copper. Now they're down to stuff that's 0.7% copper. I mean, you know, at some point, it just doesn't become economic anymore. And it becomes a massive earth-moving operation rather than a mine because you're mining such low-grade stuff. So that is where really the reserves have been replaced. A couple of other things that are quite significant, both at Escondida and Grasberg. Grasberg is in Papua New Guinea, and it's also a massive, massive copper mine. They've been transitioning from an open pit to an underground operation. There have been hiccups along the way, and so, you know, that's affected to some extent the copper that's actually coming out of the ground. So, you know, there's really not much out there that's being built. There are a couple of advanced projects. There's a few in Peru, which are being held up by environmentalists, by NGOs. There's New Dynasty's copper deposit in Hebel, in Alaska, which is in the largest unmined copper deposit in the whole world, but it's in the Bristol Bay watershed. And there's both been indigenous groups and NGOs that have been objecting to it for years because they're afraid that the runoff is going to go and affect the salmon fishery. You know, there's no easy answers to any of this. And wow, you know, what can I say? It's just getting harder and harder to permit things and harder to get things rolling in the industry in many, many of the jurisdictions for which we have gone to historically for copper. I mean, you know, the largest hole in the world, hole in the ground, is Bingham Canyon, which is just on the outskirts of Salt Lake City. That's a copper mine that's been It's still being mined today, and it started in 1905. Incredible thing. You know, there were huge deposits like that. Now, that's, I don't know how many years of life that's got, but it's finite. But there were big, big deposits in Arizona, in Montana, in Colorado, you know, all these things that I mentioned before that contributed towards the electrification of America. Massive deposits of copper in the Keweenaw Peninsula, northern Michigan, none of which are being operated anymore. It's all finished. So, I think really that the Green Revolution, as the politicians have laid out and the framework and the various world agencies are trying to promote, I don't think it's doable. I think maybe in 10 years' time, we're going to have a mix, perhaps, of, let's say, 30% electric cars on the road, and the rest will still be gasoline-driven. There are a lot of benefits, not just to the environment, for the electric car, because of the way the drivetrain is. It has very few moving parts compared to a gasoline-driven car, and potentially a much, much longer life. So there's a lot of pluses there. But I think it's going to, I think it's pie in the sky saying that we're going to close up all the gas stations in America and go completely green.
You know, as governors, presidents, Congress, legislatures mandate these new green policies and they're putting these artificial dates on them, like in California, 2030, no more gas cars. Is there anybody sitting and talking to these politicians and saying, well, if we're going to do that, we're going to have to rebuild the grid. We're going to have to make it modernize it. We're going to have to expand it because there's going to be all this draw on electricity. And at the same time, if we're going to be building all these green cars and charging stations, we're going to need raw materials like silver and copper. And you can't do that when you're trying to stop any mine from going into production. So, I mean, is anybody telling these people, hey, to make this work, this is what we got to do?
Well, maybe a few individuals like myself and folks who listen to your program, because I know you've been talking about this for some time as well, and a number of your guests. No, I think they're in la-la land for the most part. Gosh, I mean, it's a great, it would be a great outcome for the world if we could switch over from fossil fuels completely to electricity and just have green energy. But we know that the windmills are actually very high maintenance cost, and they're not effective 24/7. There's sometimes when the wind simply does not blow, and the same with the solar panels. The solar panels are no damn good at night. So what are you going to do for the base load? Well, the most reliable thing through modern history has been nuclear power. And nuclear power since the Fukushima incident has been really a political hot potato. There have been virtually no new installations that have opened in the West, though the Chinese have got 65 of them either in construction or on the drawing board. I think myself that is the solution. Now, remember, nobody died at Fukushima. It was very unfortunate and really quite ludicrously stupid, the mistakes that were made there and things that should have been fixed. I mean, they didn't even have a satellite phone on site. Craziness. There's lots of capacity for nuclear around the world, and certainly there's no lack of uranium in the ground, and we just have to use it in the best possible way and be vigilant and not let companies go rogue like they did in Japan. But certainly, in countries like India and in China right now, where the air is almost unbreathable in New Delhi and in Beijing, this is going to be the solution ultimately. In China, they're still opening up one coal-fired plant a week to run electricity. In fact, I think it might even be more than that, several a week. And really, this has got to stop. So, you know, if you're going to have a middle class that's consuming things and buying automobiles and white goods and all this other stuff, both in Italy and China, and bring up your economy, you're going to need the electricity. And right now they're getting that electricity from burning coal, coal-fired electric power stations. And that has got to change. And it's not going to change just to solar and wind. They're going to have to bring in nuclear power in a big way. Other things as well, desalination plants in the Middle East, they're going to be run by nuclear power. And these are countries with smart people, and they're able to do it right. And, you know, I don't think people should be overly afraid and scared of nuclear power. It's been around for really since the 1950s now, and they're, you know, compare it with just simply people falling off the roof installing solar panels, which is, you know, a major loss of life and injury here in North America. There's been no loss of life in the nuclear power industry in the last 12 months in America, but I could bet you that probably 30, 40, 50 people have sadly lost their life falling off roofs. So, you know, you have to take a bit of perspective in all this.
So, Keith, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about the company that you head, which is an exploration company, how could they do so? And before we do that, just explain a little bit about what you're doing, what you're looking for, and how our listeners could get more information.
Well, thanks, Jim. Essentially, my company is actually trying to fulfill the gap for the green revolution. And we're active down in Ecuador. Ecuador recently elected a center-rightist government. They're very, very pro-business and very proactive in getting new investment into the country. They've just signed some directives for the oil industry. They're about to do it for the mining industry. And various protections of investment and et cetera, et cetera. So we're down there. We found a lot of copper. We found a lot of zinc. And we have two drills turning right now. And we're very, very actively exploring this piece of property. It's in the same belt that runs along the Andean mountain chain in South America that has yielded all these fantastic copper projects in Argentina, in Chile, in Peru. Just in little Ecuador, because of the size of the country, major companies overlooked it for many, many years. There's only 17 million people in the country. And this is probably where the next equivalent to the Chilean belt is going to be. That's my hope and my thinking forward, and we're doing our level-headed best to find it. Our website is aurania.com, A-U-R-A-N-I-A, and they can find all kinds of information there.
All right. Well, listen, Keith, thanks for joining us on the program, because this is becoming a major concern. We're seeing brownouts in California, power outs in Texas, and here we are pushing full steam ahead trying to green the economy, but we're going to need things like electricity and raw materials. Thanks for apprising of this, and all the best, and come back again.
Thanks so much for having me, Jim. It's been a pleasure.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth advisory team, which has been servicing clients for over 35 years, feel free to give us a call at 888, that's 888-486-3939. Also, don't forget to tell your friends and family about our podcast, Financial Sense News Hour, to stay on top of the latest developments in the market and how they impact your investments. Lastly, if you aren't already a subscriber and would like to listen to more of our premium content airing 3 days during the week through our website or through an app on your mobile device, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense News Hour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.